Hello, everybody. This is Steve Baker, your friendly neighborhood pragmatic constitutionalist. I am just going to call this particular podcast my second anniversary January 6th special, for lack of a better title. The fact is that I was going to not do anything related to January 6th today, and then I started reading everybody else's articles, and I started listening to some other podcasts and seeing some other videos related to the second anniversary. And I thought, okay, I'm going to go in here and I'm going to script something out and fire off a quick 15 or 30 minute video. And then I just decided, you know, I'm not going to script anything out. I don't need to script anything out for January 6th. I did jot down a few notes so that I don't forget what I want to say, particularly a couple of highlights. The main thing is that this is something that did, in fact, change my life. It certainly did not upend my life the way it has for so many who have been, unfortunately, charged and convicted for crimes that they either didn't commit or that they were overcharged for just being accidental tourists that day. And again, as I've said many times before, I have no place and I have no grace for those who did violence against law enforcement that day or broke things at the Capitol. And they need to pay the price for their crimes. Unfortunately, so many others have been charged for things they did not do, or they were charged and prosecuted and imprisoned for things that they were completely unaware of. And then there were, of course, those, as we saw in the Oath Keepers trial, who were ridiculously overcharged and prosecuted for something not even in their mind at the time. So there's that. But before we get going here and before I give you these unprepared memories and thoughts about January 6th, let me get my one commercial announcement out of the way. And that is, for those of you who haven't done so yet, please consider joining our locals community. That's my the pragmaticconstitutionalist.locals.com, the TPC community, I call it. And you can access that on your phone apps, your iPad apps, or whatever other device you use. And just go to @TPC4USA. That's @TPC, the number 4USA, or on your browsers, you can get to it by going to thepragmaticconstitutionalist.locals.com. You can also get there as well by just typing in your browser, TPC4USA.com, and it'll take you to our locals page. Now, you can become a free subscriber, kind of as that read-only type subscription. You will miss out on some supporter exclusive content, but you can become a supporter of what we're doing for as little as $5 a month. And that's just a very small paywall because there's no ads on Locals. Locals does not sell your information. You are not the product on Locals. That's why that there's a small paywall there to compensate for the fact that we don't run ads there. So the fact is, you can get additional information, additional content from me on a regular basis by just as little as $5 a month contribution to what we're doing, or you can get a one-year subscription, which includes 2 months free at $50 for the annual subscription. And of course, there are always those who don't like subscribing to anything, but who would like to make a one-time contribution. You can do that there at Locals as well. So once again, the pragmaticconstitutionalist.locals.com or tpc4usa.com or the device apps. It's @TPC4USA. All right, that's enough for that. As I said before, January 6th did in fact change my life. In fact, the only reason that I went to DC on January 6th was because of COVID. And I'll get back to that in a minute. I'm not a rally attender. I don't attend political rallies of any kind, any type, anywhere. It's just not what I do. As many times as Trump has even been here in the Raleigh, North Carolina area where I live, and as many opportunities as I've had to see him, I never went to a Trump rally here. I live two blocks away from the oldest high school in North Carolina, where President Obama, President Clinton have spoken at this high school. And two blocks away where my children went to high school, I never walked those two blocks down to go see either one of those presidents. Attending a political rally just does not attract me in the least. And when I say that I attended the event in D.C. because of COVID. And that's because when the lockdowns had become really intense that year in 2020, I had decided to hit the road and start doing TPC meetups around the country and just going out to people that follow my blog and meeting them around the country. I ultimately traveled to about 28 different states. Well, exactly 28 different states, holding meetups with people everywhere that I went. I was right in the middle of doing that when I took the holiday break. In fact, I spent Christmas away from home, as a matter of fact. I got home on New Year's Eve, and then I took a couple of days off myself from my traveling, and then hooked up with another writer, a friend of mine, another writer of some esteem. He and I decided to go up there and see the rally, just to get away from Raleigh, because Raleigh was just a wasteland lockdown wise. And if we could stay on the Virginia side and eat at a restaurant with our masks off and walk around without restrictions that we had here in Raleigh at the time, that was good for me. And then of course, knowing that we were going to be going to a rally with tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands, we didn't know how many people would be there at the time, of more like-minded individuals in terms of the political side, I was pretty confident we would not have any mask requirements on us that day, and in fact, that was the case. So it was just another opportunity for me to avoid COVID restrictions and mask requirements and mandates at the time. Now, I had attended the gun rally in Richmond, basically a year before, in January of 2020. I did attend that. And the reason why I went to that is because I do, in fact, think that the Second Amendment is the single most important thing that we have to defend right now. And I've written about that extensively, so I won't get into much here, but I'll just say that of all of my followers who write me from overseas, whether it's England, Russia, Australia, New Zealand, I've had many, many, many who have concurred with me on my thoughts about the Second Amendment from overseas, who have told me that they believe that I'm exactly accurate when I write that so long as the United States has an effective Second Amendment and we are allowed to continue bearing our arms, that in fact we are the last bulwark against tyranny worldwide and a de facto one world government. I believe that, and as I said, very astute readers and observers around the world believe the same, and I've heard that many times. So I did attend that gun rally in Richmond, and that was very atypical for me. So January 6th was not typical either, but because I do write and I do blog and I do a little bit of podcasting as well, I thought I would carry my man on the street microphone, the camera, the extra battery pack, and get up there and do some interviews. I even carried my tripod. I was planning on setting up on the street corner there somewhere in DC after the rally at the Ellipse, and then and subsequently after the additional events that were to take place and that were scheduled and planned at the Capitol, and that I would interview people and see what their thoughts were and get their thoughts about everything that was going on, particularly the election, particularly the speeches that day. We didn't know if the Kraken was going to be unleashed that day. So if it had been, I was going to interview people about what their impressions of those announcements that everybody was looking forward to. The president had said it was going to be wild that day, and my thoughts, my anticipation is that he was going to release some information regarding the election that would be wild that day. It turned out being wild, but for different reasons, and for certainly reasons that were unknown to me at the time. So we arrived on January 5th, and we met with some friends that we had that came in also from out of town, had drinks up in our hotel room that night, and then got out early the next morning, had breakfast, went to the Capitol, made an attempt to get into the Ellipse area. It was absolutely impossible because of the size of the crowd and the density of the crowd to even get to the Ellipse, much less if we had even been able to get into the Ellipse area itself, whether we would have had room to be accommodated there. Just standing room only, it just didn't exist. So we worked our way back out to the Washington Monument lawn. And of course, obviously, Trump was very late taking the stage, so we heard some of the other the morning speakers, and it was all inconsequential, quite boring, as a matter of fact. We were cold, 25-30 mile an hour winds blowing. And once Trump hit the stage at 11:57 a.m., almost exactly an hour after his scheduled speaking time, it was already very apparent to myself and the other gentlemen that this was going to be a big nothing burger in terms of the speech itself. And in fact, that's exactly what it was. Not to mention the fact that it was horrific where we were in terms of being able to see the one big giant screen that was out there, Jumbotron screen, and then the audio was absolutely deplorable. As I've written before, it was like a junior high school AV department production, which is not something you would expect there at a massive rally like that in D.C. In fact, the truth of the matter is those who organized the rally for Trump, I don't think that they had any idea how many people would show up. I know that their original licensing was for something like 30,000 people. It became then, I think the day before, they upped their license to something like 60,000 people. And then, of course, as we know, hundreds of thousands of people ended up showing up that day. So myself and the other gentleman, we decided about halfway through Trump's speech to get out of there and get ahead of the crowd. And this is one of the things that's most important to understand and talk about. The one thing that the press utterly fails, and refuses to acknowledge is that there were other events scheduled that day. There were flyers, there were websites, there were publicized events. There were events scheduled at the Capitol and on the Capitol lawn prior to the announcement of the rally at the Ellipse, because that rally wasn't announced till December 19th, but there were applications for other events because January 6th is an important day on our nation's calendar. So there were other events announced and other events planned, other events scheduled and permitted by the Capitol Police. And we saw those permits in the Oath Keepers trial. They were read into evidence. So we know that those existed, despite the fact that the mainstream media is hesitant to talk about that and acknowledge that. So there were, in fact, marches scheduled, marches permitted. There was staging, and PA systems permitted on the Capitol grounds that day. So there were a lot of people going there with the anticipation that they would not be entering restricted space, but for some reason, there was a tremendous amount of restricted space around the Capitol, out at a pretty significant perimeter from the building. And that's also very atypical for the Capitol on any normal day of the week, but it was the case that day. Myself and the other gentleman, we got to the Reflection Pool, the Peace Monument, just, I would say, right around 1:15. This was about exactly the time that the president was finishing his remarks, and we were hearing sirens coming to the Capitol building, and we were seeing suddenly these fluorescent vested Metro DC police officers running down the steps to the lower terrace there on the west side. And then all of a sudden I started seeing smoke and I heard some flashbangs, and I looked over at the other guy and I said, "That's where we're going." We broke out in a run, made a circle around, got up right there, and the first thing that I captured on my camera was people getting first aid. The battle had already begun up there. People were already being injured. Law enforcement officers were already being injured. There was full-scale violence taking place at that very moment, and that was at exactly 1:19 p.m. on January 6th. Roughly for the next hour, I continued to video what was going on, very much aware of what was happening around me, trying to avoid getting hurt, trying to avoid getting pepper sprayed. It was impossible to avoid the tear gas, but the tear gas was largely ineffective because of the high rate of wind that day. So any tear gas they released just quickly dissipated and blew off. But the problem is that if you weren't the target of somebody's pepper spray because of that wind, if you were just downwind from it, you could get hit. So as a result of that, myself and my friend, we got separated. He got hit probably 7 or 8 times and said, "Enough of this." And so he went to a further location away from what was happening and got upwind so that he wouldn't be hit by the pepper spray anymore. I was holding the camera up and trying to capture as much as I can while keeping my eyes on the law enforcement officers who had those big pepper spray canisters and guns, because I knew that if somebody around me was deserving of being a target, I didn't want to be in that area. So I was constantly just holding the camera, watching them so that if I needed to move, I would get out of the way. And then, of course, sometimes the battle line would come out my direction and I needed to move again. And then at some point, they were launching those concussion grenades into the crowd, flashbangs, I guess they called them. And they were launching those into the crowd, and one hit about, 3 feet from my right leg. The shrapnel hit me in the leg, and I carried a bruise, pretty significant bruise, for several months thereafter. And then about 2 o'clock-ish, there was suddenly a very marked, what I called at the time, a stand down that happened. And then law enforcement officers began to pull back. And then that section of the scaffolding where they had torn, where the protesters and rioters had torn the canvas off and were up underneath that battling with police for position, suddenly that became a free flow of humanity shortly after 2 o'clock. And it was just all of a sudden what was a very heated exchange going on up in there just stopped. And as I said, I interpreted it at the time as a stand down order. I've since learned that it was a pullback order, that the Capitol Police had received instructions to actually all go inside the Capitol building. Now, all of them did not make it in before the doors were locked, but they were in fact ordered to go inside. And that was the pullback that I saw with my own eyes. As I got to the upper terrace there on the northwest side of the building, or the Senate side, it became apparent that for some reason, some way, somehow, that hundreds of people were flowing in through an open door. I didn't see the door open. I didn't see the window busted. I just had my camera going, capturing as much of the event as I could, doing what a journalist should do, which is follow the story where the story was going. And that's all I was doing that day. I was not a participant in any violence or any property destruction, or certainly nothing even organized that day, because I was just there to cover the event, not knowing what was going to transpire before my very eyes and before my camera lens. Ultimately, I followed quite a large crowd of people into the Capitol building. And then from that point forward, for about the next half hour or so, I was witnessing quite a number of things. Again, just really focusing on capturing as much of the important scenes that were going on around me as I could with the camera, while also avoiding some of it. There wasn't a tremendous amount of violence because that front line of violent perpetrators, provocateurs, instigators, agitators, they had already done their damage and moved on. They had moved then to the east side of the building. Some had actually extricated themselves and come around from the outside to the east side. So there was a coordinated effort on the east side that we now know took place, both from the inside and the outside, to breach that famous Columbus door, as they call it. But that's another story in and of itself. I was not a witness to all of that. I've just seen all of that in the videos since then. But what I was seeing was mostly, as I've called them, the accidental tourists that were in the building that day, people that had no intention of quote-unquote storming the Capitol. They just looked up and saw the same thing that I did after those violent provocateurs had breached the police line and after the stand-down order or pullback order had been issued, and then after those violent and property-damaging provocateurs had in fact busted a window in and opened that first door from the inside. After those people were inside and dissipated out throughout the Capitol, then it was just like curious people going, there's a door open, and they started walking in. And I ended up following that group in. And that's basically what I saw the entire time I was there. Mostly, not entirely. There were some significant moments. I was at the main House door hallway, House of Representatives main door, when tear gas was released. At that point was just almost exactly at the moment that Ashley Babbitt was shot. I don't know if that was in response to that. Probably not, because that was on the other side of the chamber. And it was also impossible to hear from one side or the other what was taking place, especially with the crowds chanting and singing USA, USA, Stop the Steal, Whose House, Our House, and then the national anthem. That was a pretty recurring theme, those various chants and that one song. What I was endeavoring to do was to stay up and away from the bulk of those crowds, because I was in a very, very dense a crowd of people at the time that I went in. And so I would on occasion move up, maybe stand on a bench or something and get up above the crowd and film what was going on. And when the tear gas was released in that hallway, it was a stampede. In fact, I was repositioning at that point to find a safe place to capture good video. And then all of a sudden you could hear the cries of tear gas, and that crowd turned and stampeded the other way. And I was pinned up against a wall and didn't even have the camera running at the time, which is one of my regretful moments because I wish I had captured that exact scene. But as soon as it had cleared out, then you can see me and actually ironically ended up in some mainstream news reports, videos, and papers. You can see my back with my backpack and my tripod and my backpack. You can see me walking into the green cloud of tear gas towards the House chamber door. And that was about, as I said, that was about 2:46 p.m. I think Ashley Babbitt was shot at 2:44, so it was very much around exactly the same time. And then probably one of the most significant events that I caught all day long was as I moved around down the hallway towards the other side of the chamber, more on the south side of the building. It was the place where I captured by the House Ways and Means Committee doorway, and then the big gigantic stairwell that's just outside of that doorway is where I captured for the first time all day, guns drawn by the various officers. Almost every officer in that stairwell, and there were quite a few of them, had their weapons drawn. And then also just right in front of my camera frame, then emerged the ATF tactical unit with their automatic weapons. And that was the first time we had seen any of that all day long. What I subsequently learned was that apparently the ATF and the FBI were already in the building. Now, whether that was in response to the evacuations of the Senate and the House members or not, or if they had been there all day, that I do not know, but they were there and they popped out very quickly as I entered or approached that stairwell. And then probably the most significant thing that I captured was just shortly thereafter when I was, I've told this story before, when you've been at the Capitol all day and your mind has been completely focused on the kinetic energy that was going on around you after I saw the violence break out. Never even thought about a restroom all day, but hadn't seen one, hadn't seen any porta potties anywhere. And this gentleman up there in the stairwell asked a U.S. Capitol Police officer if there was a public restroom somewhere close. And she answered him. She said, "No, I don't know." She said, "I don't usually work in this part of the building, but you're free to go downstairs and see if you can find one." So for the first time all day, I started thinking, you know, I might need to find a restroom myself. And so I turned my camera off and I started down those steps myself, started the process of looking for a public restroom, wandering around downstairs in the lower level of the Capitol. At this point, I was entirely alone, nobody to bother me, no protesters anywhere. Didn't even see that other gentleman. Maybe he found the restroom. I didn't. And as I was kind of wandering aimlessly looking for a men's room, all of a sudden someone grabbed my right arm and I looked over and down. It was a very short female Capitol Police officer. And she said to me, "Sir, may I safely escort you out of the Capitol?" And it was as she was walking me towards the south entrance or exit door that we came up upon the FBI tactical units and medics working on Ashley Babbitt. They had moved her downstairs and were trying to save her life. Again, I did not have the camera running at the time, but as we stood there and I looked over at the officer and I said, "Is he shot?" Because I couldn't tell because even though the shirt was off of whoever was there laying on the floor in front of that door, just to the side of that south door, there was a lot of blood and there were hands, you know, doing CPR on her. And so you just don't assume automatically that that's a female, and I just saw blue jeans. And so I said, "Is he shot?" And she said, "Yes, he is." And I said, "Who shot him?" She said, "We did." I said, "Why'd you shoot him?" She said, "He pulled a gun on us." Now, that's the kind of thing she was apparently hearing on the radio chatter or talk amongst herself with the other officers, fog of war stuff, not disinformation. Nobody was making anything up. They just didn't know at the time. It had just happened. And as we all know, most of those officers didn't see what happened. So it's conjecture. And again, you don't think of a lady getting shot in a situation like that. Right then, the gurney is being brought in by the EMS unit, and we have to step back away from the door as they come in. And then when they get past us, then she takes me to the door and she says, "Please be safe, sir." And I said, "You too." And so I got out knowing that that gurney had come in that door, that that's the door that it would go out. So I was actually inside of a police line at the moment. And this was one of the remaining police lines out there. All the rest of them had been breached. But it was inside a barricaded police line, fully guarded by law enforcement officers. And I was right in the middle on the inside of it, and nobody said anything to me. So I just walked down the ramp, walked around, and posted up right in front of that door. I turned the camera on, knowing that whoever that was would be coming out that door shortly. And in fact, 30 seconds later, that door opened. And then 30 seconds after that, here comes with fully armed escort from the FBI tactical unit and the EMS first responders were bringing this gurney out, and they were working on somebody very feverishly, still just doing compressions and still trying to pump air and still trying to stop the bleeding. And as the gurney was being brought down the ramp, I followed it down with my camera, got closer and closer. And then finally, you can actually hear me on the camera frame going, like, holy crap, it's a woman. Because now I could see her bare breast, despite the blood. It was very obvious. And then her, unfortunately, and this is the memory I'll never be able to shake, is her lifeless eyes. Her head was turned my direction as I'm following down with the camera. And I will never forget that. In fact, as soon as they extricated her off into the distance, I loaded her up, I stopped and pulled out my phone and I texted, still trying to get, I had not been able to get a text out all day, but I did type the text and I did hit send. And I said, shots fired, lady's been hit, she's not going to make it, is exactly what I texted, because I've seen death before and I knew that this person was probably already gone. Certainly death had not been declared officially at that moment, but whoever that was, I knew was not coming back from what I saw. And then that wasn't the end of my day, but it was the end of the excitement, we'll call it. And then, of course, as I said, my life changed after that. Skipping forward to the next morning, I actually began to get calls from Fox News and other news agencies that wanted to secure my videos. And then I actually spoke to an actual worldwide agency themselves and signed a deal with them to license my videos. And subsequent to that, I immediately got home, squirreled myself away for 5 days and did frame-by-frame analysis of my video. And then I wrote my story. I think my first story came out on the 13th, so exactly a week later, what I saw on January 6th, and it was a 9,500-word story, start to finish of my day. And then I started posting my videos out, getting them up. So my story was out, and when my story was out, I hit the road again. And then it was becoming very apparent, because arrests were now being made around the country, that just for being inside the Capitol, not because you did something wrong, that possibly I had become a target and that I could be arrested, prosecuted for just having been in the building. So I started following the stories of other independent journalists who were inside the building that day to see what kind of reaction they were getting from law enforcement, from the FBI. Some were interviewed. Some were subsequently arrested. Some were not. There's a lot of questions about the selective prosecution between different journalists, independent and otherwise, in terms of their activities that day. And I've asked a lot of questions about that. Myself, I was not interviewed by the FBI until, well, I actually received a call from them in August. So 8 months later, I finally get a call. In fact, when the special agent introduced himself at 10 o'clock in the morning on a phone call to me. Ironically, I had one of my TPC meetups in a suburb of DC just the next evening. And he called me that morning and said, hey, after he introduced himself, I said, what took you so long? And he chuckled and we chuckled. And he said, yeah, you know, we've had a lot to do related to January 6th. And we're just getting around to you. I said, well, okay, well, let's do this thing. He says, as a matter of fact, I see that you're going to be in, I'm forgetting what the suburb was at the moment. It was on the Virginia side. And he says, see, you're going to be there tomorrow night. Would you be there early enough in the afternoon? We could sit down for a couple hours and have a conversation with you while you're up in the area. And I said, yeah, I'm going to be there and I'd probably have the time. I said, the problem is, I said, my attorney probably won't be able to be there. And he goes, oh, okay, well, no problem. We can reschedule this when your attorney is available. I said, yeah, let's do that. I said, why don't I have him call you? And that's exactly what happened. So from that point forward, it was in my attorney's hands. We eventually had a scheduled date that was called off at the moment, the very moment of the interview. Myself and my attorney had actually arrived at the FBI headquarters here just outside of Raleigh, and we were turned away because, even though it was scheduled, because they, the two agents that were going to be interviewing me, had received notice from DC that because of my own standing as a journalist, a member of the press, that they in fact could not interview me without expressed written permission from the U.S. Attorney General's office. Who knew? I didn't know at the time, but I know now. And sure enough, they were not able to actually ask me a single question as because of that. And those letters were acquired, and we did a little negotiation in advance. And about a month later, in fact, I did the interview, and they were very professional. They didn't play good cop, bad cop on me, but one guy was a little bit more aggressive than the other guy. I thought the interview went very well for me. And I did this despite the fact that I'd received ample warnings against speaking to anybody related to that day, but I did it anyway. For one thing, I didn't have anything to hide. Number two, I didn't do anything wrong. Number three, I wasn't even there as a Trump supporter at all. And those of you who have read me over the years know how I feel about President Trump. And then in addition to that, I was there as a journalist. And so I felt good about my situation. The only thing that I knew that I couldn't do in that interview was tell a lie. So as long as I didn't perjure myself, I was good to go. So I didn't. And that's the way it was. And they told me that it was not up to them whether to file charges or not. Certainly I've learned since then that they make the recommendations often, if not always, after those interviews. But some time passed then after that, and then I got a call from my attorney the week before Thanksgiving. I think that was November, I want to say it was November 13th or something like that. My attorney said, I've got bad news for you. He said, I just received an email from the assistant U.S. attorney up in Philadelphia who has your case, and they are in fact going to be filing charges on you within the week. And in fact, after I saw that email, that's what it said. She said, I'm just letting you know that you can inform your client that I expect charges to be filed within the week. So that was the weekend or the week before Thanksgiving of 2021. And here we are now in January 6th, the second anniversary of the big day. And those charges have still not been filed. So it's been 13 months plus 13 and a half months since they threatened me with prosecution, or actually said they were in fact going to file charges. Now, what we did is we had, upon learning about that, we immediately launched into a full frontal press and media offensive. And I've done interviews relentlessly since then, but we did a very concentrated dose of media interviews over the next few days. After that announcement, we did a press release that went out to about 200 different news organizations, media organizations of various types, and many of those responded. I ended up doing interviews on the first anniversary of January 6th, exactly a year ago today, with everyone from Russian television, British television, French television, Newsmax, and down the line. And so the point being is that this was not something that I wanted. It was not something I was looking for. It's not something I normally do. I don't attend political rallies, much less am I the guy that chases riots. It's just not something that I ever thought I would do. But I found myself in the middle of that. And as I said, I followed the story where the story went. In fact, I've always said that I was much more content to write and comment on the stupid stuff other people did rather than doing the stupid stuff myself. But I caught myself in a very stupid situation that day, and have subsequently continued my process of writing about it. I became an investigator of all things related to January 6th, and I ended up covering, of course, the Oath Keepers trial for the full 9-week duration of that event, and many other things. I have other projects related to January 6th that I'm continuing to work on. I have a big story coming out next week that I've collaborated with a writer from the Epoch Times. I like to say the Epoch Times so that I sound more high-minded and European. Since then, my life has changed. As I said, it's not been so terribly disrupted as it has ruined other people's lives and the lives of their family members. But mine has certainly changed. Since then, because of my own involvement, my own coverage, my own investigation, stories that I've worked on, the likes of Julie Kelly, Dinesh D'Souza, and other media figures have started following my works and sometimes even sharing my stories. So that's a big difference for me. I just had a conversation the other night just a couple of evenings ago with Mr. Alan Fuhrer of the New York Times. And I'm sorry, I probably mispronounced his name, but he's the one that famously wrote the story about Ray Epps in the New York Times that he was greatly criticized for, received criticism from yours truly, myself. And then I had the opportunity to meet Alan at the Oath Keepers trial, and we had many very pleasant conversations together during that time period. And after after the Ray Epps story started trending again here this week because of the release of the January 6th House Select Committee transcript of his interview there, and he was trending again because of that, I wrote something in which I tagged Alan in, and then he responded to me in a private message and said, hey, let's talk. So we did. So he called me the other night, and we had another pleasant chat about that. He even said to me on that call, he said, the conversation was about Ray Epps, and he said, you can report everything that I say. In fact, he even said, and please do. Now, I'm not going to report everything or talk about everything that we said in that conversation, but he's a true believer in the innocence of Ray Epps, and he's a true believer in the fact that Epps is not a Fed or was not working or in the hire of any other government agency, and that he was acting on his own. And he believes that any allegations to the contrary, in his own words, and he uses this phrase a lot, is crazy town. And he said that several times. On the other hand, Alan also accurately reported the fact that the number two guy at the Oath Keepers was in fact an FBI informant. And how do I know that it was an accurate reporting? Because I was there with him when we learned that, in fact, the number two guy at the Oath Keepers was a confidential human source of the FBI. I reported it in my first tweet storm out that morning at 9 a.m., and then Alan's story came out, I think, around 5 o'clock-ish that afternoon, a full article, and then, of course, made national headlines and was then shared and covered by people all over the place. But at the exact same moment, from the exact same source, we both learned about the FBI informant at the exact same moment. And we just reported it in our two different ways. And of course, he has a much larger following, and his story went viral itself as well. But he remains, as I said, a believer that Epps is not a source, or was not a source, or an informant, or an operative of a federal agency at the time. He knows that I continue to disagree with that, especially with new evidence that has come out. And I'm not even talking about necessarily the transcript, because the transcript itself is embarrassing for the House Select Committee, as far as I'm concerned. I've never seen somebody who is ostensibly should be a hostile witness of sorts, a guy who, in fact, was a former Oath Keeper himself, a guy who claimed to be a hardcore Trump supporter, a guy who claimed to be an election denier, a guy who claimed to be there to see Trump that day, for all the reasons why a leftist committee made up by Pelosi herself for this select committee should have been more hostile to Ray Epps. It was a softball interview, and it was embarrassing, the questions, even particularly from Adam Kinzinger, which I also have written a story about here just recently, I think this week, maybe. So it is a confluence of different events where Alan and I disagree. And the main thing is this new evidence, this new video evidence that's been released, and I'll provide that link again. It became very apparent that even though Epps' testimony to the committee and elsewhere is that he was only there with his son and his son's friend, we now have seen video of him being escorted away from the violent front line of activity there on the west side, and that he is led out by four other individuals and followed by four. So the nine together, you can see them snaking their way through the crowd out. And this is from Capitol closed circuit television cameras that this event was captured. It's very apparent that he was not acting alone, and as he has claimed and as he has testified in his interviews. There's still a lot of open questions there. Is there absolute evidence that he was a Fed? No. There's not. I agree with Alan on that. There's not any evidence, but there are a lot of circumstances that raise a lot of questions. And the most significant one for me is, how is it that someone who did far more that day than others who have been arrested, who have been swatted, had the red dots on their chest at 6 o'clock in the morning, have been hauled before a magistrate, who have been stuck in a jail, that have been charged and have spent time in jail for just being on the property that day, have in fact not been arrested. But this character, Mr. Ray Epps, hasn't been. And as I've said before many times, and I probably will say it many, many more times, is that the revolver story, which they were the first ones to break a really big expository story on Ray Epps, I think back in October or November of last year. Oh, wait, last year. Now I'm saying, got to say 2021. We're in 2023 now. So November or October of 2021 is when they released their story and made national headlines with that. It's not the revolver story. It's not the right wing that turned Ray Epps into a key January 6th figure. It's not revolver or the right wing who created the conspiracy theory. It's the government itself by their kid glove handling of his story, of his interviews. And although I have not read the FBI 302 interview of him, which Alan Fuhr told me was not a kid glove interview, he's seen it. But everything I have seen reeks of some sort of cover up. It just does. Do I have the evidence? No. Does anybody else have the hard evidence? No, we don't. So on that count, Alan is correct. Do I have unanswered questions? Very much. Do I see with my own eyes and my own intelligence, my own common sense, selective prosecution by the government related to him as compared to others? Yes, absolutely. That's exactly what I see. So there are reasons that we do still have conversations about Ray Epps, and legitimately so, even more so after this new video evidence that had come out last week. So as I said, J6 continues to affect my life. I've even been asked just last night, I received a call from a couple of attorneys who have asked me to testify in an upcoming January 6th related trial, which may alter some of my travel plans. So it continues to affect me, even though I'm back to trying to branch out a little bit and to refocus my own commentary, analysis, and reporting on other things that I find interesting outside of all things related to January 6th. But that's part of it. And I have a feeling it's going to continue to affect me much longer. And just like I said, that it wasn't the right wing or revolver that created the conspiracy theory around Ray Epps, it was the government that did that. I also will tell you that I was content, as I said before, to just write about the stupid things other people did and not go out there and do them myself, and not to chase those stories down specifically, but just to be an analyst and comment on political things. That was my comfort zone before COVID came to town. And it was the government's reaction to COVID. It was the lockdowns. It was the mandates. It was the violation of our civil liberties in all things related to COVID. And then it was January 6th, and it was the government's selective prosecution, and it was the unanswered questions, and it's those unindicted individuals in the crowd that we have full high-definition facial captures of, who have not been so much as charged or even put on the FBI's most wanted list, that have all of those things combined together have turned me into an investigative reporter, something I've never cared to do or be. I'm just following the story where the story goes. So and that continues to happen up to this day, and I know it will continue to happen for a long period of time to come. So that's my January 6th story. I'll leave you with one thing. This was an interesting coincidence, anecdotally, that happened today. I received a message from a journalist who wanted a copy of one of my videos. And because he's a friend, I don't mind going outside of the agency, and I shared the video with him. And he's going to use it, about 2.5 minutes of it, in an upcoming story that he's writing. And I sent him the video. Did the Dropbox link thing to him. And then a little while later, he sent me a private message, and he said, "Can you give me the exact timelines when such and such happened in that video?" And so I actually said to him, "It's at 2:46 p.m. on January 6th when that moment happens." I hit send on the message and looked at the time, and it was exactly 2:46 p.m. today, 2 years to the moment from when I captured that event that he was asking about. I responded with the timestamp, and when I responded, it was exactly 2 years to the moment from that timestamp. There you go. It still affects my life. Every day now seems like every minute. All right. Once again, I just want to remind you, please follow us at our locals community, thepragmaticconstitutionalist.locals.com or tpc4usa.com. You can get there either way, or you can go get the app in your app store, and also there it would be at tpc4usa. It's free to subscribe, or you can become a supporting member there. Either way, we'd love to have you join us. Once again, this is Steve Baker, the Pragmatic Constitutionalist, and I'm sure I'll be talking about January 6th again soon, but also a lot more. I hope you'll join us over there and everywhere else where you might find us on the interwebs. Take care.